But I think these are two moments where Jane is finding herself. She finds herself with other women, like you're talking about, and in that reflection and connection with nature. So that's such an incredible point that you're making there.
What Jane has been searching for most of her life is family. And at the end of this chapter, she finally has it. And to her, that is more important than the money. And it like baffles St. John. And I love that kind of discussion that she has with him about, she's like, you've grown up with sisters. I've had nothing. She's like, I don't need all this money. It would burden me. It would freak me out. It comes with too much responsibility. Be my brother. That's what I want. I want family. And I love that joy that she has in that moment of that realization. Lillian, good morning to you. How are you this day?
I'm doing so good. I am, as you just so nicely put it, drinking my brown drink to stay alive.
Yeah.
And I see you're drinking, I believe, your brown drink to stay alive.
I am also drinking my brown drink. For people of this podcast, we stan whatever brown drink gets you up in the morning. So I hope you're enjoying yours.
Or if you're out there and you have a green drink or you have a red drink, for a morning beverage, we actually support all drinks.
You know, it's true. We're taking that stand right here. Welcome to the inclusive podcast where all drinks are good drinks.
In case you guys haven't picked up on this bizarre energy, which might be new or might just be always what you experience when you turn into Air Buds. tune in, not turn in. I'm doing great.
I mean, some people, maybe they just really embody the show and they turn into this every single time they listen to it. So if that's you also, we love you. Thanks.
Yeah. So we're recording in the morning. Piper's on vacation mode because she is heading out of town.
Yeah.
But we did it finally. And we read, I think like half, maybe a little over half of the St. John chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. God.
Okay. So honestly, yeah, I dragged my feet on this like when before starting, because I was like, this is going to suck. I don't want to do this. But honestly, once I was in it, there was a lot about this section that I appreciated. I wouldn't necessarily say I liked, like, I wouldn't be like, ooh, if this was the entire book, I would totally read this. I wouldn't. But I'm like, no, there's lots of important stuff here. So I'm ready to talk about that.
I think I was worried that reading Jane Eyre would feel like lit classes did in high school, where it's like, unless you have somebody guiding you through this, you're going to not enjoy it because it's not like a good, it's like a good piece of artwork. It's not a good, like enjoyable story.
Yeah.
I have not felt that until this section. And I literally, we were messaging each other last night. You sent me just like a little heads up being like, hey, I'm taking some notes for like a deep analysis. And I was like, I literally messaged you back. Thank God. I have nothing to say.
Oh my gosh. Dude, I think you're actually going to really like some of the points that I'm bringing up for our discussion today. But I think, so apart from hard to get through, any initial like comments or thoughts, or should I start with our guidance?
My opinions on St. John have not changed at all, except potentially getting worse. What a boring man. The only thing that I think I was wrong about with him is they have never cast a like really, really hot guy. And that's who they were supposed to cast.
Right. Exactly.
I have some other more like nitpicky thoughts, but like genuinely my biggest thought was just like when I read some of the longer nature scenes and stuff, it's just, I like it when someone explains to me why it's cool, but I just like don't have the kind of energy where I enjoy picking apart why it's cool for myself.
Totally.
And in reading that, there's a lot, like the parts that I was the most like, oh my God, Jane, please stop describing what the Moors look like. I get it. You're very hungry and you want bread and you went to a few different houses. Why can't you just say a few different houses instead of describing every interaction, Jane?
See, the parts that I felt like that was anytime I turned a page and there was a huge chunk of monologue and they were always St. John talking. And I'm like, God fucking damn it. I know your profession is to talk at people, but leave the job at home, St. John. Like, these people are so bored. And I will get into this in more detail, but I kind of loved in the like later half, especially of chapter 33, where Jane was also just like, she's like, shut up, just shut up, just tell me what you want to say. Just like literally yelling at him. And I'm like, yes, finally, thank you.
That is what I enjoyed. Like, genuinely, that was probably one of my favorite parts, was like the way that they built to Jane being just like herself. And I think that's the parts of these chapters that I was anticipating and I'm glad to see. And I think we're going to see even more of now that Jane has her money. Cause we, so we read from the part of Jane basically getting losing all of her money at the beginning of the part that we had it, cause she forgot her parcel in the carriage, into Jane finding out that she has 20,000 pounds that she's going to split amongst her surprise cousins. But I think that that's the part I was looking forward to, is Jane's internal character growth, that like, I get it. It's got to be hard to put in an adaption. I think we're going to see more of that in the coming chapters, but let's talk about the ones we read for today.
Let's do it. So my first note here, because we begin with Jane describing, you know, what happened to her after she was left at what is essentially a signpost in the middle of some crossroads in the middle of the moors, and how she deals with her destitution. My first note is, I feel like this would be a curious writing exercise for an author of any time period to say, how do you survive when you have nothing? And so for Charlotte, she's answering that question in, what is it, the 1600s, is it?
Yeah.
And then I think that'd be...
Sorry, not even a little bit the 1600s. I just agreed with you.
What is it? What year? What century does this take place?
1847.
Okay, the 1800s.
You're just off by 200 years.
Hey, don't worry. Well, you know, if Jane had to do this in the 1600s, it'd probably be even harder for her.
Or easier because society had fewer rules.
Yeah, someone, you know.
This is our new question to our readers. Email us, listeners. Email us.
It's morning. Brown drink.
Anyway, email us what you think the difference would be if Jane Eyre happened in the 1600s.
But what I think is so interesting is, this idea where, like what you just said, with if it was older, maybe she wouldn't have the societal problems. But then think about, like, someone who finds themselves in that situation today. Like, how do you go about that? I mean, yes, there are lots of charitable organizations, but there's so many, again, like roadblocks and rules and all kinds of things. And I just think it's really interesting of like, how do you get into that mindset? And I'm also so curious to know if she actually like interviewed people who had been in situations like that, or is just using her imagination.
Well, and I also think there's a lot of commentary. There's a lot of commentary on religion in these sections.
Yes.
And something that I was thinking while reading these is, I honestly think we sort of skim over the religious aspects of this book in general, because it is a pretty sensitive subject. It's a very personal subject. And then there's this theology conversation that can be had with this book. I feel like it would be worth having an episode about that, so we could talk about that potentially in the future. But I think there's a commentary on the idea of charity and compassion that happens in this that is the most interesting part of this to me. And I think that that is one of the pieces that is so interesting in that section of that question of how would you survive? Like, if you had literally nothing, how would you survive? And the first place she goes is to nature, and nature does not have enough for her. But I think when you, when in our own lives, you, I don't know that I would react. You like to think that you would react differently if Jane Eyre showed up at your door, right?
Right.
But I don't know that I would, because of the examples in my own life. I lived in downtown Minneapolis for years. I was a single woman. It was not safe for me to assume anything other than danger by people who were experiencing homelessness and did not have resources and needed compassion and charity potentially, but I could not assume that they were safe people to be around. That my experience with that evolved the longer I lived downtown. I got better at telling the difference between people who were going to be dangerous for me to interact with and people who were harmless and fine, but I still didn't welcome them into my home and wouldn't have.
No, I feel exactly the same way. And I think that's where we find Hannah's reaction, right? It's the middle of the night. It's storming outside. Here comes a woman who she doesn't know, who looks, you know, clearly distraught. So who knows what she's going to do, like, emotionally. And yeah, it's this kind of sort of fear. And that's, I think it's so interesting that when Jane is talking to Hannah later, Hannah says, she's like, no, I wasn't being cruel. I was trying to protect the girls. Like, I'm the only one who's here. We're all alone. Who knows what you could have done? But then a note that I also made about kind of, I feel like, I know that at the end of that conversation that Jane and Hannah have, they shake hands and Jane says that they're friends. But there is sort of this, I think, standoffishness. And one thing that I kind of read into it is, because their house is so kind of like secluded, they have this kind of like already set up little community. Mm-hmm. And I feel like maybe Hannah was partially threatened, if not only by like the potential danger of a stranger, but also like, who are you to come and disrupt this like system that we have? Mm-hmm. Will you replace me? You're looking for work. I'm the one who works here. Like,
yeah.
I think that's all things that she was possibly considering.
For sure. Absolutely. I think there's those layers to it. And the other thing too, is like, let's pretend for a second that Hannah didn't react that way. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say that she saw Jane on the doorstep and immediately invited her in. That if we know that it's Jane, right. Mm-hmm. There could have been a lot of things that happened there. One, Sinjin could have reacted poorly to that. It's his decision. He said, something that I have never picked up on, at least in adoptions, is he says, I was listening and I heard that whole conversation. Hannah did the right thing. And now it's my decision to invite this woman into the house because I think Hannah is misreading the situation and mm-hmm. Jane is the exception to the beggar rule. So what mm-hmm. that says to me is, based off of Sinjin's morals and Hannah's morals, if Jane wasn't a rich woman or at least a privileged woman mm-hmm. and instead was like actually a beggar, or God forbid someone outside of this standard British society, mm-hmm. they would not have let her in. And in their book, that would have been the right thing to do.
Right.
And we don't know that, like, I don't mean this in a poor people are dangerous and so you should worry about them way. I like the examples of today, for example, when I lived downtown or whatever, there were two guys who would get drunk on my front step. I learned to know who they were. They were totally safe. They were really nice to me. And I kind of always felt like they were looking out for me a little bit. But there were other people who would I had a guy follow me home from work once, like walk with me home from work, mm-hmm. And ask me a lot of super specific questions and yeah. ultimately try to ask who I lived with.
Yeah.
That was not a safe person.
Yeah.
And if you don't have, when I first moved downtown, there was no way for me to distinguish between mm-hmm. those different people and what was safe and what was not. And especially if you live in this small town and this is the first time a beggar has come knocking at your door, mm-hmm. you have no way of knowing if that person is safe. And Sinjin is in a really privileged position to be able to, even if she is dangerous, invite yeah. her in.
Right. That's actually a conversation that I've had before with Sam, because Sam is way more inclined than I am. If we are stopped at an intersection and there's someone asking for money, he'll often like give them something. And mm-hmm. we've talked about that. And I tell him about how like I always feel so guilty when I am uncomfortable helping somebody because mm-hmm. I feel as if I'm not necessarily safe. And I feel like as a man, you maybe have a bit more security of feeling like, well, if someone tries something, like mm-hmm. I can handle myself and handle them. And Sam, he agreed with me. He's like, yeah, no, totally. Like I definitely feel more in control in those situations and you have to look out for yourself. So it's interesting.
And another layer of it too, is those people are less likely to try something with Sam because he's a man.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And that's not, I would say when we say this, 90% of the people in those positions, like, and this is out of nowhere, right? Like most of those people are probably safe and like fine and not good, but
yeah.
I don't have the privilege of playing that game.
Right.
Like it's also to talk about today and then I'll drop that. But I think it is somewhat true at that time as well. And it's not, we think of this as individual problems of mm-hmm. what should Hannah do? What should John do? What should you do? What should Sam do? What should I do? Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is it's a societal problem.
Yes.
And while we as individuals don't have the resources and safety and privilege to solve that, mm-hmm. we as a society have plenty of homes, food, shelter. Like we have resources to help anybody who's struggling with additional issues that are making it more difficult, whether it's mental health or addiction or some combination of the two, yeah. or just like a lack of resources and bad luck for a few years, you know,
right.
Whatever it is that those people are facing, as a society, we have enough that we can help them. As a society, that town had enough to help Jane.
Yes.
They had, and she ended up helping and serving them way more than any yeah. of the people who gave her a crust of bread did.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
No, I completely agree. I want to go back to one note that you said about St. John, like whether or not he would have let Jane in if she wasn't like a person mm-hmm. of privilege or from that background. Mm-hmm. So there's a line that said, I can't remember if Hannah says it or if one of the sisters says it about St. John, or if it's just an observation that Jane makes. But it's said that he is so dutiful in his like job of serving people, but it never comes across as if he actually cares. Mm-hmm. Like he will trudge through the storm to go see a sick person. But mm-hmm. I think the whole time he's probably thinking in his head, he's like, either he's like, this sucks, or he's thinking, God will bless me for this deed. Like, I think I don't see him as like genuinely caring. So I think if he saw Jane on his doorstep, he'd be like, the right thing to do is to bring her inside. But then if after like studying her face and determining what kind of person she is, barf, if he was like, oh, this is a totally poor wretch, tomorrow we're mm-hmm. going to send her out. Like the storm's over, she's leaving tomorrow. But because yeah. he was like, oh no, she's got nice clothes, maybe she should hang around. Like,
well, and like, and he doesn't have the resources. Like he says to her, like that he can help her get a job, but he is not in a position to help her with anything beyond that because he just doesn't have the money to do that, mm-hmm. which is a very fair response. And she would have died if he had not brought her in. Like, but I think I agree with you. I think the point Charlotte is definitely making in this section is the idea of motivation and how does motivation change it? He at one point even says that his sisters, Diana and Mary, are motivated by compassion and he is motivated by charity, which he puts as like an unemotional piece. He talks later about the idea of the reason he's going off to do this missionary work, which I think would reserve your spot in hell, at particularly at this time, is he's laying a foundation for his mansion in the, like in heaven. He is not doing this. He is not giving up this love that he has and leaving and going to spend his time on Christian charity because he feels it is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. He is doing it because the Bible told him mm-hmm. that this is how you get a good spot in heaven. And heaven is going to last so much longer than your sad little life here on earth, Jane.
Oh my God. Yeah, completely agree. St. John is the worst. Speaking of which, my next note is literally the fact that while she's like semi-unconscious and laying in bed, he like says out loud how ugly he thinks she is. Like, it's like, dude, you're the worst.
His sisters are like, no, stop it. If she's super sick. Like, I bet if she eats some food and gains a little weight back and gets a little color in her face, because she's so terrifyingly pale right now, which I can relate to, that she's going to look really pretty and you're being kind of a dick, St. John. And he's like, no, no, no. Look at like the features of her face. God. She's an ugly, ugly pig person. Jane doesn't disagree. She's not offended. No.
She's like laying there half dead. She's like, he was right though.
Super accurate.
Oh my God. So I have a lot of notes about St. John and his beauty. One of my next things here is I wrote down parallels galore because I think it's so interesting that she has come from being in love with a passionate, wealthy, not so attractive man. And now she finds a stale, handsome, poor individual. He's literally the mirror of what mm-hmm. Mr. Rochester is. And it's just, there's this whole thing about St. John, I think, partially because he was born so beautiful, that mm-hmm. I think it kind of gives him a chip on his shoulder, and that he knows that his family used to come from wealth, that mm-hmm. now he is this kind of a poorer stature. And I think he's like, I look pretty and I used to have this, but like, I'm just so humble and I can't have the things that I want. So I might as well just, I guess, do good, but not for the sake of good, but for the sake of my own good. And maybe that'll be fine. And it's just like, dude, get over it. Like, I think that really set him off on the wrong path.
Totally. Plus he sucks. But also... But the parallels, I think the one that in what you mentioned really jumped out to me is that idea of the parallels between him and looks super clear that you can see all of that stuff. They look really different. You can see it in their motivation. But I also think we spent so much time in chapter 27 talking about the fact that Mr. Rochester was at a crossroads and had to ask himself, do I go with the rules and conventions of society and religion? Or do I find my own way and my own structure of what is right and wrong? Mm-hmm. And St. John at some point he sort of talks about that idea that he was in a similar, had to make similar choices in his life. And he chooses to disregard any feelings that he might have because those are deeply unimportant, which he talks about a lot, but instead follow the rules of Christianity and understand the Bible and lead people towards this because this is how he understands it to be, which we could and potentially will talk for a long time about whether or not he properly interpreted the Bible. He, whatever he came up with, I hate it. but that is, that's what he believes. Like and I think that is the commentary on religion that this makes. We've talked a lot about Hot and Bothered.
The Hot and Bothered podcast. Yeah. I was thinking about them the entire time I was reading this section.
They look at it with an incredibly religious lens. They bring in experts and talk about it. So if this is particularly interesting to you, I would recommend going and listening to some of those episodes because they talk about it from that theology standpoint with a level of detail. I have not I intentionally don't listen to the chapters we're going to talk about before we talk about them because otherwise I'll just regurgitate all their amazing points. But
one of the main hosts of that show, by the way, she has a novel that she published and it's literally called Praying with Jane Eyre. And it's about how she went through her kind of understanding of faith in addition to like what is said in this book. And I believe she identifies as atheist, but it's like this kind of discussion that she takes and uses Jane Eyre as sort of the basis of comparison for that. So I, for one, would love to read that book. Who knows? Maybe we will and talk about it on the show, but
we keep coming up with more and more stuff. I really didn't think this podcast would last this long. And the fact that you guys are here and listening, thank you so much. We got to come up with more things to do and we have a long list, but certainly let's add it to it. But I think that idea of how do you identify right and wrong? And the thesis of that, when you look at the good characters and the bad characters, I think we can put St. John not in a, he's doing bad things. I think he's doing good things, but he's in the category of a Mrs. Reed, of a Brocklehurst, of a rule follower, of a, the structure and the society is what is worth upholding. You find a set of rules, you follow those rules. You don't think about what that means. You do not let your feelings or your passions run your life. Yeah. And the characters we love, Rochester, Helen, Miss Temple, Jane, run their lives the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next note that I have has to do with the nature sections that you found so boring.
But I'm so excited. I found them boring in the same way that like I truly hate Old Man the Sea, but I believe that people like it. Yes. Like I believe there's something there that I'm missing. I'm never going to like Old Man the Sea. I hope to like the nature scenes of Jane Eyre.
So my note on this is not so much about the nature, but more so how this is our first glimpse of happiness for Jane in a long time when she's out walking with Mary and Diana. And I think it's happy for me to see that when Jane is in nature by herself, because before that's been something we've talked about where that's where she and Rochester can like connect and show their feelings for one another. But the fact that just being in nature alone, now that she's away from her destitution and has found this like happy, like female companionship, she can just appreciate it. And then that natural joy that she finds in this space comes back to her. There is a lot that I want to talk about Jane, like who she is outside of her being attached to Mr. Rochester. And I think it's a bigger conversation that can be had about all female characters and all women in the world of who are we when we are just ourselves versus who are we in relationships? And does the fact that we may be different when we are with somebody that can be a good thing and that can be a bad thing. But I think there's something very special when you are the same person, when you are you by yourself and you with that person you love, because then you know you don't have to make any changes. But I think there's a thing here that I picked up on anyway, of now Jane is away from Rochester. She's not so bogged down by all these thoughts of class and not being able to be with this man that she loves. And is she good enough for him and all this stuff? And now she's kind of just reflecting on her own like joys and being with these other women who, you know, are supportive and happy and feeding off of that energy. And I think finding that in herself again.
Oh my God. That's such a great point. That's so something that I've thought about a lot in this section is we've talked about before, I read a lot of romance books. And my least favorite part of the romance books is always the third act breakup. And that's what we're in, right? Yeah. And I think the ones that I enjoy, the ones that do it well and pay out that third act breakup, are not doing it because that's the way the story goes. Mm-hmm. They're doing it for the reasons you're describing, which is a character needs to find themselves, needs to center themselves, and there's work that they need to do before they can be with this other person. And I think that that is absolutely, it's the reason why at the end of chapter 27, when we were talking about whether we'd stay or leave, my conclusion was I would stay, Jane has to go. Mm-hmm. Because one, Jane's morals told her she had to go. But I think the second part of it is, as much as she's seen examples of these people she cares about, mm-hmm. Helen, Miss Temple, Rochester, like we said, having their own internal mechanisms and their own connection to right and wrong, and that those, that sort of larger picture of that why to these things, mm-hmm. she is still in a position where some of those whys for her as to why she's moving forward, why can't she be with Rochester even though he's married? Yeah. And why is he okay with being with her? That her whys there are still religious, not necessarily her direct connection with God, but the ideas of God that the religious structure has given her, and societal. It's illegal for her to marry Rochester, and she doesn't have any legal claim to him or religious claim to him unless they are married. Mm-hmm. So she's still somewhat in that structure. Yeah. And she loves him. And we see how even leaving, that love does not disappear. It does not dissipate. It does not diminish. Mm-hmm. And, but she's following the rules of the structure and meets someone who is the epitome of the structure. Yes. And is not evil. I think we could put Mrs. Reed and Brocklehurst in the category of not just following the rules of the structure, but manipulating the rules of the structure for their own gain, yes. in ways that are deliberately hurtful. Where Jane sees an example of that in St. John, where he's not trying to do bad things. He's just following a set of rules for a payout later. But he's not, I don't think St. John is a bad person. I think he's boring and stupid. And when he goes off to save savages, he definitely does become a bad person in my mind. But I think that that's Jane seeing that and exploring that and doing that within herself, mm-hmm. and in a space with female friendship, which mm-hmm. she only ever had at Lowood, mm-hmm. even though she had a friend, you could argue she had a friendship with Miss Fairfax that was really different from what she has with Diana and Mary. It's different from what she had with Miss Temple. It's different from what she had with Helen. Mm-hmm. But I think these are two moments where Jane is finding herself. She finds herself with other women, like you're talking about, mm-hmm. and in that reflection and connection with nature. So that's such an incredible point that you're making there.
Well, thank you. And I literally have been having kind of like chills as we've been talking about this last section. I'm like, dude, we're so good at this.
I know. Keep that in the podcast so people know that we know.
But yeah, no. Oh my gosh. There's a whole essay that could be written about that topic. Totally. And I think as much as, yes, we have to suffer through St. John, I think that is one thing that I honestly really enjoy about this part is it's Jane's finding herself moment, like you talked about, of those romance novels, of her finding first her independence and her happiness, of being like, okay, I know, like this whole thing of what Rochester said before, like there's a look about you that says I can live by myself or whatever it is. If honor requires it. Here she's gone out, she's done it, she's proved that to herself. So now she has that badge of honor that she can carry with her and say, you know what, I did. I survived. I'm contributing. I'm happy. I don't have a lot, but I'm okay. And then we have the spiritual thing, which again, yes, this comparison against St. John, I think that's a way for her to say, you know what, doing things just for religion's sake leads to him. I don't want to do that. So I honestly thought to myself, once she got the fortune, I'm like, okay, I feel as if now Jane might think to herself, I could go back and see Rochester and be like, hey, like, you want to take me to France? Like, I'm not gonna, like, we can maybe smooch now. It's fine.
Which of course I think we'll see. Yeah. I'm hoping we're going to see more of how that, I think in chapter 33, we see a lot of her finding that voice, mm-hmm. and we see her not only being centered in herself, and having her own house and her own job where she is guiding these other young women, mm-hmm. and being accepted into this town and this society for who she is as a person. that I think is giving her more and more of this confidence that then as she knows Sinjin and knows the ways to communicate with him, she understands that A, he's not really going to be that offended if she tells him to sit down and tell her what's happening. And B, she has the confidence to just do that and just call him out and just, and she's doing that in a situation where it's not Rochester drawing that out of her, mm-hmm. which we see in the other chapters when Jane is most honest about what she, who she is and what she wants. It's when Rochester is either forcing her to by painting her into a corner mm-hmm. or demanding that of her as he yeah. sits by a fire and says, tell me things. Talk to me.
Be yourself. And she's like, ah.
So it's fine. It's fine being in a position where she is actually the one drawing that out of someone else because yes. she now has that confidence in herself. I think I'm anticipating seeing more of that Jane in the next few chapters before she goes back to Rochester, which I'm excited about.
Me too. Okay, so my brain is a little fuzzy. Remind me, what is the name of beautiful, kind benefactress Rosamond that Sinjin is absolutely obsessed with? One of my notes here is so I first wrote down, okay, the fact that he like is so opposed to this woman who like loves him and he loves her back, but he has all these stupid things in his head. My first thought was, I wrote down, Sinjin is an incel. But then I was like, wait, incel means involuntarily celibate. I'm like, no, he's just a cell? Like, because he's not involuntarily, he's voluntarily being like, no, I can't be with this gorgeous woman who loves me. It's like, oh my God, get the fuck over it. I love Rosamond. She seems absolutely charming. Like, I felt like she was, like, her energy felt like it was bubbling up off the page in those descriptions of her.
She feels like somebody we would like adopt into our friend group and be like, sweetie, don't marry Sinjin. I know he's beautiful and I get it. You guys would have the prettiest kids. Mm-hmm. I understand. He's so boring, honey bun. So boring. Just come hang out with us. We're going to have way more fun over here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do not marry that man.
So I love how Jane dedicates a couple of paragraphs to describing Rosamond's beauty. Like mm-hmm. first when she sees her for the first time, then when she's like describing the drawing that she does of her. And then again, when she's like, oh, she would come by on her little pony with her footman riding behind. And I'm like, dude, Jane, you've got a girl crush on Rosamond. I mean, no worries. Yeah, like she sounds absolutely phenomenal. But where was I going with this? Oh, there was something else. Yes. Okay. Speaking of Jane's girl crush on Rosamond, Jane seems really horny in these chapters. Did you get that too?
Absolutely, yes. And the moment that I thought about is when she's talking about like her dreams about Rochester and just like in general is like really trying not to think about him, but is sort of obsessed with him and has that like underlying like, girl, what is going on with you and your obsession with looking at people and like all this other stuff. It reminded me of the 2006 adaption has that scene. Is it 2000? It's 2006, right?
I think you're thinking of the rain. Oh, you're thinking of the 2011, right? Where she imagines that Rochester comes and they make out, but then it's just Sinjin and she's like, oh, boo. Is that what you're thinking of?
I am thinking of that. Is that 2011?
That's 2011.
That's 2006. Okay. Yes. That scene is so similar. Just the 2006 is so horny in general. That's right. Why I assumed it was the 2006 one. but that scene where he comes, like, we know it's a dream, but like, it's actually not clear if you don't know the story that it's a dream at the beginning, mm-hmm. that he comes through the rain and they're making out. And then Sinjin knocks on her door and that wakes her up from this dream. That is so true. It's not explicitly in this book, but it's similarly to some of the other things we talked about where it captures the feeling of these chapters in a way yeah. that is better than a lot of the other ones.
Right.
And I think that it captures the horniness for sure.
Right. Like there's passages where she talks about, she uses the word love in a lot of very interesting and I think sexual ways where she's like, I would love him and he would love me. And it's like, who would take me as his lover? And she talks about like this delirium of like just being loved. And I'm like, she's just imagining being in that like villa and just having sex for like hours and then being like, okay, let's go out to dinner.
Like, okay, let's go out to dinner.
Yeah. It's like, we need some food so we can keep banging.
Piper! I literally, for our listeners, you don't get to see me. I was literally fanning myself.
This is Jane's thoughts, not mine, Lillian. Blame her.
Oh, okay. But yeah, no. And I think there's an argument to be made, and we don't want to talk about how horny Jane is for too long. But she talks a lot about how beautiful St. John is and a lot about how beautiful Rosamund is, mm-hmm. and a lot about how beautiful they would be together. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that Jane doesn't want them to fuck.
She totally does. She's like, guys, just do it.
Guys, listen, all I'm saying is, like, you guys like each other and you should get married.
And then she'll just be like the Jane in our SNL sketch we just watched. She's like, just let me listen at the door.
Just Jane's little teacup with her eyebrows up.
So good. Oh, I love it. Okay. Yeah. My last few notes are just, I've got that John's faith, keeps him, he thinks it's, keeping him from temptation, but really it's keeping him from happiness. I have my note about Jane being horny. oh my God, though, the sweetest thing. Okay. So the only adaptation that I have seen where this has kind of been hinted at is in my favorite, the 80s one. Where they actually do a scene where Rochester talks to the solicitor. And he's like, you have to find her. Here, yeah. It's so interesting that it's actually something that St. John tells Jane. This idea, there's a line where he's like, the country has been scoured far and wide. He put out like ads in newspapers being like, have you seen this hot governess? Like, looks like an elf. Isn't though? Wish she was.
Okay.
Reward if returned.
And it's the drawing we talked about way earlier.
The stick figure. With the circles for boobs and the little ears. Yes.
Yes. We're going to need you to do a drawing of Rochester drawing Jane that we can put on our Instagram.
I gladly will.
Thank you. I look forward to that text later today.
Amazing.
Oh my God. But I something that's interesting there though, is I don't think you're wrong in that maybe it was Rochester, but my understanding from reading it was that it was the solicitor for her uncle that was really looking with that level of intensity.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
Although I figured it was Rochester. Also, he probably also used Rochester's drawing because it's the only drawing they have of her.
It's like, really? You don't have anything else?
Listen, anybody who knows Jane is going to know the elf ears and the boobs.
It's like, this is pretty clear, okay? I'm paying you a lot of money. Print it.
This is as accurate as you can find of a picture of Miss Jane Eyre.
Oh incredible. My God.
I want to talk a little bit, when you were talking about the nature, it prompted something for me thinking way back to the beginning of this section, in those moments when Jane literally has nothing and she is figuring out a way to sort of survive. And I think I say she's figuring out a way to survive. I think if Jane had walked into that town and immediately gone, hey, I'm like from out of town. She had all this energy and vigor, and she was like, I'm looking for somewhere to work, and just like went to the different places in town and found all of these things and was trying to do it that way. I think things might've gone better for her. I think if she had found, she could have gone to the clergy, the church right away, found St. John, he would have offered her the thing at the school. She wouldn't have almost died.
Yeah.
The state she is in is still that state that I said the state she is in is the same thing I said at the end of chapter 27, where it's not that she wants to die. It's that she doesn't care if she lives and she isn't planning mm-hmm. on living.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a she's planning on dying way. I mean that mm-hmm. in a she's not really planning at all. She's so down to her base needs. Mm-hmm. I need shelter. I need to sleep. I need to drink some water. I need to find some food. Like, that is the driver of that chapter 28.
Yeah.
And I think what is interesting to me, and the things you talked about with nature and how is Jane alone in nature, is in the moments when she is just looking for comfort and shelter and guidance, she sees things like the woods and feels comfortable with that idea. She sees the different places that she's able to find and lay down and sleep. She does not complain about the places she's sleeping. Mm-hmm. The things that drives her back to other people is her need for food mm-hmm. and her like those base needs again.
Yeah.
And I think that it's interesting that she does not find comfort with people. She does not find welcome with people. But when she goes back to nature, she feels comfortable. She just doesn't have all of her needs met.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting connection that I hadn't made until you were describing the nature pieces there. And I think that layers in that difference in the connection to God that we were talking about, yeah, where St. John finds that in the structure and in the rules and in the pieces of God that he finds in the Bible, where Jane mm-hmm. finds it in the woods.
Dude, oh my God, I love that comparison, Lillian. Not to get too real, because I should save it for our biblio or whatever, theological, bibliotheca, our theologic discussion episode. But me personally, I'm one of those people who would say I identify more as spiritual than religious, mm-hmm. and God is in nature for me. So I love that you made that connection for Jane. That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Love it.
Well, unlike always, we don't have to do hour and a half long episodes about everything.
It's true.
So maybe we did it.
Yeah. I think just one last thing that's important to note, we don't really need to dissect it. I think just the fact that what Jane has been searching for most of her life is family. And at the end mm-hmm. of this chapter, she finally has it. And to her, that is more important than the money. And it like baffles St. John. And I love that kind of discussion that she has with him about, she's like, you've grown up with sisters. I've had nothing. She's like, mm-hmm. I don't need all this money. It would burden me. It would freak me out. It comes with too much responsibility. Be my brother. That's what I want. I want family. And I love that joy that she has in that moment of that realization.
Yeah, I absolutely agree on that. And I think, similarly to the idea of like, what do you value? Do you value the structure? Or do you value the thing? If you value the structure, the 20,000 pounds is the important thing. I did write down next to Jane's moment of like, when you get at 20,000 pounds, dude, the reaction isn't yay. The reaction is, what a responsibility. And I was like, I don't think that will be my reaction, Jane. And I don't even need the like inflation. Like, I don't even need like the time. Like, if somebody gave me $20,000 today, mm-hmm. my reaction would be yay. It would not be worrying about the responsibility of that money.
My reaction would also be yay, but I can relate to that comment of hers in different situations where I've definitely experienced like someone offering me something that seems like it's like a really cool, exciting thing. And my reaction was a sense of panic. Mm. Typically it's been with stuff like, we've mentioned before that I am an illustrator in my free time, and I've had a few opportunities where someone comes to me and they're like, hey, this is like a really big opportunity. Would you like to do art for it? And I'm like, I'm like, me? No, I'm not good enough. Oh, I can't do that. I can't balance that with my work and my social life, and everyone's actually going to hate it. So please don't ask me, ask someone else. Like, it like kind of freaks me out. And I feel like that's kind of where I saw that similarity of like, it's like suddenly you're a wealthy lady and you're really important. And Jane's like, that's not me. I'm not that person. What? And so that's kind of where I saw that vibe. Still, yay to 20 grand, gimme, gimme, gimme. But also I can see where she's coming from.
When you put it that way, I think that registers for me a bit more as the responsibility, if you make it not money, because I do think it's a time difference as well. And mm-hmm. I mean that between the UK and the US, like it's so many different hours. No, I'm kidding. I'm really funny, guys.
So funny.
It's like that at that time, that money comes with status and status comes with responsibility. If somebody gave me even the equivalent amount of money, right? Like even if I got like $1 million or whatever it is, that does not come with status in the US anymore. I mean, it might come, it comes with the ability to purchase myself some status if that's what I want, but it's totally up to me what I choose to do with that.
They're like, Lillian, we have a check for $1 million, but it also comes with an interview on Good Morning America. Now you have to start producing your new soap brand. You have to like put up five hotels. It's got to be organic or else everyone's going to come down your throat.
And you have to manage this process. And also if you want somebody else to do it, you have to hire them and train them and trust them. All these things. I'm like, Jesus. Okay. It's a lot, guys. Yes. So I think that makes sense as well, where it's like, I've had similar things with the number of times that people have gotten calls from me when I get a new client for my business. I'm like, guys, I got a client. I asked them for a lot of money and they said yes to a lot of money. I have to do the work that I told them I could do. And I don't know that I can actually do that work, guys.
If
and it works out.
Yeah, if we want to put a modern term on it, I'm sure she would be overwhelmed by imposter syndrome.
Totally. And I think it's the idea, you know what, speaking of modern things, I think it's similar to the idea of suddenly going viral for something,
right,
where it's like that simultaneous joy and opportunities and the way that things can open up there. If you've been a creator, like if AirBuds suddenly went viral, let's say suddenly AirBuds becomes this big thing that people are listening to, which frankly, I'm a little bit overwhelmed by how many people listen to it already. If we suddenly had millions of listeners, I don't know that I could do this anymore.
That being said, we love each and every one of you.
Yes, because we've built relationships with you over time, and we hold you dearly in our heart. One of our listeners fully is a raccoon, and I love them for that.
Lynn's referring to an account on Instagram that's just raccoon pics that follows us.
And she has very strong opinions about Jane Eyre. And every time I literally messaged her and was like, I know you're not literally a raccoon, but I picture you as literally a raccoon who has strong opinions about Jane Eyre. And she sent back like a little like, haha, you're not wrong.
Very cute. Oh, I wish it was like a picture of a raccoon reading a book.
Her whole Instagram account is like six pictures of raccoons. It's so cute.
Very cute.
Anyway. All right. Speaking of our Instagram, you can find us at AirBuds on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you want to find the raccoon account, just go look at the comments in some of our recent posts. Spectacular.
Yeah. And if you want to share your thoughts on this chapter, is it as difficult for you to read as we thought it was going to be? Do you actually really love this chapter? If you do, tell us why. Send us an email. We are airbuds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And if you really like our show, even though we just said we don't want millions of followers, we want a few hundred more.
Yeah, we'd like you and three of your friends to listen.
And your mom and your dad and your aunt and your favorite raccoon.
Please don't invite your favorite raccoon. Only invite your second favorite raccoon.
Oh, yeah. The favorite one will probably like share with all of the raccoons in the forest, and then we'll be overwhelmed.
We don't want raccoon influencers. We want raccoons who are going to enjoy Jane Eyre. We want only those raccoons.
So to share it with those guys, a 5-star review and a nice note helps a lot. So
know somebody who knows a lot about theology and knows a lot about Jane Eyre, please email us about them as well, because we might want them on the podcast.
100%. But yeah, Lillian, what's coming up next for us?
Oh God, I forgot. My whole job. Okay, hold on.
Lillian, what's up next for us?
So next week, we are going to be watching the version of Jane Eyre that we had actually asked our listeners to help us find. I do not remember who specifically found this for us. We will thank them next time. Someone from that Jane Eyre Files Facebook group, which we so appreciate and love hanging out there. They were able to find us a version of the 1952 movie that we can watch. It's another TV movie similar to the 1948 movie that we, 49. My brown drink is not working yet. similar to the 49, where it was a made-for-TV movie back when they had those sort of like Sunday classic movies or whatever that they would make. So we are going to be watching that for next week. And then we have some really exciting episodes coming up after that. So we've got a lot of cool things coming for you guys.
Yay. We love you guys so much. Please join us for those. Our thoughts and reviews are just for you guys. So we'd love to have you back. But until then, we'll say goodbye for now, and happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye.
See ya.